Welcome to this, the special Independence Day 2009 edition of Ford Forum. John Quinlan here. Stephanie Woods is off for the month of July and early August. She's on the Act 7 AIDS ride, and I was going to be, rather, in the second week in August, and she is out training again today after a 50-mile ride yesterday, another 30-mile ride tonight. Be doing the show solo for the rest of the next several weeks, but got some great shows planned, including one today. One of my favorite shows of the year is always involving the 4th of July. And we have just an outstanding guest on the line. His name is Ray Raphael, and he is the author of a great new book called Founders, The People Who Brought You a Nation. Ray is also the best-selling author of A People's History of the American Revolution, which was edited by Howard Zinn. And he's taught at a one-room public high school, Humboldt State University, the College of the Redwoods. He's a native of New York who now makes his home in the Redwoods in Northern California. Again, those among his 12 books, Founding Myths, A People's History of the American Revolution, and The First American Revolution, all available from the New Press. And Ray Raphael, welcome to Ford Forum.
Pleased to be talking with you.
Hey, it's good to have you here today. I mentioned in an email to you, one of my favorite traditions this time of year is taking a listen to the musical 1776. And I realized historically, there are a few inaccuracies there and everything. But, you know, since I was a teenager, I think that's something that's really caught my interest in terms of just really bringing this story alive. And one of the great things about your book is you take the notion that we had just a handful of founding fathers and turn that on its head in terms of just making it really clear that this was a revolution that involved multiple folks. That it was a collective effort. And before we get into those themes and everything, though, I just wanted to play a little excerpt from 1776 just to kind of evoke on a humorous note the fact that those founding fathers and probably some of those folks that we don't know as well, you kind of wonder what was going through their heads at the time in terms of, would they have lasting memory, over time and in the history. Here's a dialogue between John Adams, as played by William Daniels, and Ben Franklin, as played by Howard Da Silva.
Well, what will people think?
Don't worry, John. The history books will clean it up.
Well, it doesn't matter. I'll not appear in the history books anyway. Only you. Franklin did this, and Franklin did that, and Franklin did some other damn thing. Franklin smote the ground, and out sprang George Washington, fully grown and on his horse. Franklin then electrified him with his miraculous lightning rod, and the three of them, Franklin, Washington, and the horse, conducted the entire revolution all by themselves.
I like it.
And Ray Raphael, that evokes for me, this notion that we do have this kind of romanticized notion of history, almost a fictional version of it that needs to be debunked. You know, where did that come from?
I don't know if you could hear my chuckle, but that's in a nutshell, actually, that describes what's happened to the historical rendering of the revolution, just going narrower and narrower and narrower. In fact, it hasn't been narrowed to two men and a horse, but it has been narrowed to about seven men whom we think of as the founders. And this has been a gradual process, but it really started in the 19th century when very, very self-consciously the writers of children's books were trying to get together kind of a pantheon of heroes and then pump them up through whitewash stories such as the cherry tree and so on, Washington and the cherry tree, and promote these to young people and offer them as heroes to emulate so that they would be good patriots and, of course, would also join the army.
And it goes beyond just limiting it to those folks. I mean, there are some real basics about this story that over time have become distorted. For example, Patrick Henry's favorite quote, "Give me liberty to liberty death, or give me death." That wasn't his quote, was it?
Yeah, well, that's a good example because that was Patrick Henry's first biographer was a fellow named William Wirt, who was just a marvelous orator in his own right. As a matter of fact, he gave the official oration in Washington on the 50th anniversary of independence. So I mean, this guy was no small potatoes, and he was also an excellent speechwriter, and in fact, that's proven because he wrote Patrick Henry's speech 42 years after Patrick Henry delivered it. You know, I mean, Patrick Henry did deliver the speech in March of 75. He delivered a rabble-rousing speech to mobilize the forces, but it wasn't the one that William Wirt made up for very different reasons. And the only firsthand account we have of that speech, it has a kind of different ring to it. It says Patrick Henry was calling the king a knave and calling the Brits a bunch of cowards who wouldn't come out to fight. And, had a whole other different ring. And we do happen to know that Patrick Henry used slave baiting and Indian baiting to mobilize the troops. So that's probably in the speech there, too. You know, he's basically striking fear in the hearts of white patriots, saying if you don't join and fight, the British are going to free your slaves and use the Indians to raid your farms.
And another great example, again, on one of those myths, I think that at least has made it a bit into the mainstream, is the mythology surrounding Paul Revere's ride. He didn't get that word out about Concord and Lexington alone, did he?
Well, that's an interesting myth because, in a sense, and what makes it so interesting is what it hides. I mean, on one level, you could say, well, a story is a story. They do no great harm. But if you'll bear with me a little bit, I'm going to just go over Paul Revere's myth and then tell you the thing that it hides. I mean, it literally washes history under the rug. Well, I guess you don't wash under the rug, do you? You whitewash it, you sweep it under the rug, and then you mix metaphor it somehow, and you get the two. But anyway, the Revere Ride, it's Longfellow's poem. Listen, my children, you shall hear the midnight ride of Paul Revere. And then he goes on to tell how Paul Revere was about half the poem. He's waiting on the Charleston shore for the signal lanterns, one if by land, two if by sea. And, of course, by Revere's own account, he gave two accounts, one right afterwards and one a few years later, in some detail. And he never waited on the shore for the signal lanterns. He was involved, as were other people, in the ploy to use that as a message, as a signaling device, but somebody else waited there. That other person took off on his horse, and we don't know. History has no further record of what happened to that person. Meanwhile, other distortions in it, Paul Revere actually embarked on his version of the ride. I mean, you know, the actual ride after he crossed the Charles River at 11 o'clock. Well, at 9 o'clock in the evening, 2 hours before that, word had already arrived in Lexington that the British were on the move. And people were already gathering in Buckman's Tavern and, you know, figuring out what to do. And Revere himself was captured twice. He never made it to his final destination. I mean, you know, the whole thing is really just, it makes a good story. And the reason we keep repeating it is because it's a good story. It's basically a child story. And child stories are the ones that keep the elemental, you know, forms intact. You know, a lone hero accomplishes an amazing event. Well, first of all, Paul Revere was not a lone hero. He did not wake the sleepy-eyed farmers as in the story. Remember, this is invented 86 years after the ride. It's as if we're making a story up now about World War I, and then that story enters into the textbook as fact. I mean, that's how amazing this is.
Yeah.
Imagine making up a child story based on flimsy evidence, distorting that evidence terribly, and then putting it in the history books as fact. Well, those sleepy-eyed farmers, let me just tell you a bit about them. The year before that, you know, this is April of 75. Well, back in August and September of 74, so we're talking about 7-8 months before that, the farmers throughout Massachusetts rose up and overthrew British authority, totally, politically, militarily, the works. In Worcester County, for instance, they were very upset because the British had withdrawn their constitution. So, you know, I mean, you and I would be pretty upset with that. Somebody takes away our constitution, disenfranchises us, we have no vote. These people had been used to meeting in their town meetings for 150 years. People in Massachusetts had town meetings. All of a sudden, they're outlawed. I mean, this is insane. So people rose up and said, no way. In the town of Worcester, one of my characters, who I used to anchor the story, Timothy Bigelow, he's just a village blacksmith in Worcester. It's just a small town, 300 citizens. about, you know, about 1,200 people, 300 adult males who can vote. And anyway, he helps mobilize through the committees of correspondence. They meet in his house across the street from the courthouse, and he gets involved with the other towns and their committees of correspondence. And on the day that the local courts, which is actually the local government, the farthest reach of imperial authority, is going to meet under this new outrageous law, you know, basically the Massachusetts Government Act, which gave the people no power, they vowed to close down the government. And they did. From throughout the county, from the Connecticut line, you know, on the south, to the New Hampshire line on the north, from 37 townships, here come 4,622 militiamen and riding into town. We know how many because one of the participants actually counted, you know, like company by company, which usually they don't get to do. You know, you just hear these crowd estimates. Well, how can you do this? Well, this guy had an they lined up in very specific units so the guy could count them. He did, 4,622 of them in 37 units. These people lined up along Main Street and in their company formations, their militiamen, and forced the two dozen Crown-appointed officials to emerge from the tavern in which they had been kind of corralled in the middle of the town because they wouldn't let them in the courthouse, to emerge from there and take, each one had to put his hat in his hand and then recite his resignation. I will no longer do anything to uphold this terrible, illegal, immoral act, which is intended to enslave the people. In slightly more erudite terms than that, but that basically was what they had to say. And then they had to move on down to where other people could hear them because these lines are lasting for about a quarter to a half mile.
No public address systems in those days, of course.
So they had to say it over and over. Remember, with hats in their hands on a hot day.
Yeah.
And it's September 6, 1774, until they're all done. And then they actually line up all the Tories in town, have them give a recant, basically say, hey, we're no longer going to do anything to support the British imperial authority. So this is the complete, total, humiliating turnover of power. After that, British authority is absolutely absent forevermore from Worcester, from all of Worcester County.
And you make the point that Worcester is a very typical place in terms of Massachusetts. 95% of the folks lived in rural areas or small towns like Worcester.
Exactly, and it's just Worcester because that was the capital of Worcester County. Now, in other places, you know, Springfield, same thing for Hampshire County, Great Barrington for Berkshire County, Plymouth for Plymouth County. Now, in Plymouth, the people were so pumped up after this. Once again, there's about 4,000 people. They did a similar event. And afterwards, they go down to and surround Plymouth Rock, and they try to lift Plymouth Rock and bring it up to the courthouse to commemorate their event.
Wow.
Well, they didn't. You know, they could overthrow the government, but they couldn't lift Plymouth Rock. But, I mean, that's the power of the people. Now, this is happening. After this, by the way, all these people say, well, you know, British authority's gone. The old establishments aren't happening. In Worcester, they instruct their representative, Timothy Bigelow. This blacksmith has become a representative to the new provincial Congress that they're putting in place of the old system. And they tell him, it is time to raise a new government as from the ashes of the phoenix of the old, no matter what our enemies might say. In other words, independence. We're ready to go on our own and form a new government, and I want you to start doing that. They're issuing instructions because that's the way they did it back then. I mean, these were very democratic times on the local level. All these town meetings would always give instructions to their representatives, you know, how they want to vote. So Timothy Bigelow is instructed. He's a leader, but he takes his orders from the people. So it's a whole different dynamic. And he's one of my characters and founders, so I to reveal this story. And then, at the provincial Congress, they collect taxes, they procure arms and ammunition, they store a lot of it, some in several places. The two biggest are Worcester and Concord. You'll recognize that name, Concord, and that comes in here in a minute. They train, they form the militiamen, they train weekly or at least once a week, training through the winter in all these small towns so that they're ready. They set up a intelligence network for which, for instance, that one if by land, two if by sea, that's, you know, one of, you know, hundreds of signals that pre-range signals that they've got, you know, church bells ringing, shots shooting, you know, all this. And all this stuff gets activated the night of Paul Revere's ride, by the way. So anyway, the when the British do march, the spy reports, we have the spy reports. They said, where are you going to march? And, I mean, where should we attack? Because, of course, they're not going to sit by and lose this entire province, you know, that's basically rebelled and overthrown their authority. They're going to try to reassert their military control over it. They're going to march somewhere. Well, their spy says, don't dare march at Worcester. It's too far away, the train's no good, and the people there are just so numerous, and they'll maul you. You don't have a prayer. So that's why they marched on Concord.
And before we move into that, I just want to reset the show for anyone joining us late. Again, this is Forward Forum here on Madison 1670. WTDY, and our guest on the line from his home in Northern California is Ray Raphael. He's the author of Founders, The People Who Brought You a Nation. A couple of things I want to punctuate before we move further into the chronology. And you mentioned this, but just in case anybody missed it in passing, the events you're talking about here are in 1774. And in the history we learned in school, it all started at Concord and Lexington in 1775. That's when the revolution started. But you make the argument in your book, based on all of these things that were happening, this quiet revolution that swept the countryside, that really Concord and Lexington was more of a counter-revolution. It was the British reacting to an enormous amount of history that had already occurred.
Exactly. And all that history, you talk, when this gets back to your original thing about the power of mythologies. When this story, by the way, is in the contemporary histories. You know, they relate this story in its basic form, but then Paul Revere's ride comes in and waking the sleepy-eyed farmers. Well, how can you have sleepy-eyed farmers if they've already staged a revolution? So when that actually enters the textbook as fact, and every kid for 50, almost 100 years is made to recite that poem. There's absolutely no place in the narrative for this much richer story. So that's the big danger. And then, you know, that Declaration of Independence saying we want to form a new government, that is 21 months before the congressional version today.
Wow.
21 months. So that's how far ahead. And when you think about what we lose in history by narrowing the story either to two men and a horse, as in the 1776 little riff there that was just hysterical, or to the seven or eight men who we basically do in our you know, core narrative that we have now, or in the 19th century they narrowed it to 56 people, the signers they call them. Well, 56 was too many, and a lot of these people, you know, kind of disappeared from history. So that's what, you know, eventually that got narrowed to the seven or eight that we have. When you do that kind of filtration, you just lose. You lose not only accuracy, but you lose the heart and soul of the revolution.
Yeah.
This is the largest mass movement in our nation's history, and certainly the most successful. Imagine if the civil rights movement or the labor movement had been so successful that it actually took over the government.
We've got just a few minutes before our first break, and I want to return to this theme throughout the hour, but you had mentioned Timothy Bigelow, and we'll come and talk about his life in a little bit more detail a little later in the hour. But the point I wanted to bring out that you bring out so well in the book, and you mentioned in passing here, is he wasn't what we think of as a conventional leader in the sense of being charismatic and being about him and about his influence and about what he accomplished. He was a facilitative leader, and that's what they were looking for in those times when they were trying to escape this tyranny. And that's the piece that isn't so neatly written about. Let me put that in for a question. Why is it that we're so nervous to attribute what happened to a collective movement, to a grassroots mass movement, as opposed to singling out some of these individuals?
Well, there's several strands to that. One is it started in the early 19th century when they actually expunged the term rebel from the textbooks. These books that they're making for kids, they don't want to glorify the term rebel.
Mm.
I mean, they're trying to establish a new government and make it stable. The last thing they want to do is accentuate the truly radical or rebellious or revolutionary nature of the revolution. So they form it in this other term of, you know, patriotism, and then then they create these people who you can emulate. That's kind of one strand. That's sort of the political strand. The other strand has to do with the nature of narrative. The nature of narrative is we always like to put agency on a single person. So let's say say we wanted to talk about the committees of correspondence, for instance, we don't just, you know, that sounds a little abstract, committees of correspondence. So you find in the books, it goes Sam Adams' committees of correspondence, like he kind of owned these things, you know. And then sometimes the committees just disappear and it just becomes Sam Adams. Sam Adams did this, Sam Adams did that. And so it's kind of a shorthand for history that eliminates the group effort because we like individual protagonists.
Let me put something else past you. Have you seen the movie Sicko, Michael Moore's movie?
No, I haven't.
Anyway, there's a scene in there that aside from his critique of the healthcare system, and he focuses in on France a lot in this regard, one of the things he talks about is the notion that in France, the people aren't afraid to take to the streets when things aren't going well with their government. But here, we're afraid of the government coming down on us when we take to the streets, especially post 9/11. I just wonder if part of the analysis and part of the reason this history continues to be perpetuated to this day is a fear that, for example, given current circumstances and the failure of the corporate elite and the failure of healthcare and all these other profound things that are affecting people in fundamental ways. Isn't the status quo now afraid that we would somehow recapture that revolutionary fervor?
I don't buy that quite as I think that's a little bit oversimplified. I think there are cultural values in here that are more significant than that, than the outright fear. I mean, when you're talking about that kind of fear, I think you're talking about the crackdown in Iran and stuff. I mean, those people really have fear, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And with good reason. And also, there was an element in the very post 9/11 environment, you know, like just immediately after. If you took to the streets in favor of, you know, the rights of Muslims, you'd be in trouble. But you know, things have changed. I don't think we, in a long-term kind of way, we have these periodic sort of fevers of that kind of that level of fear that you're talking about. But I think there's something else going on in American culture, which is and it has to do with this individual heroism. We phrase everything in terms of individual.
Yeah.
Individual this, individual that. And in revolutionary times, Timothy Bigelow was not going into, when he stood up to the British and he was elected captain of his militia unit, and then he went off to the provincial Congress, then he went off to war. He was not doing that as an individual. He was doing that as a functioning member of his Worcester town community. These people live together. They worship together. They consider themselves a collective unit. And there was a sense of the public good. Now, if you mention that term, the public good now, just that innocent term, the public good, you're going to be accused of being a socialist.
Yeah, yeah. Well, although let me mention maybe a more apt present-day parallel here, and that is just the phenomenon of what happened last year or throughout the election cycle. What we heard countless guests tell us on this show was this isn't just about one man, about Barack Obama. This is about a movement, about collective action, about grassroots stuff that, thanks to new media and thanks to the energization of young people, was bubbling up from the bottom. Do you think there's a parallel here in revolutionary times?
Yeah, I mean, any leader is only going to be a leader insofar as there's a mass of people to you know, allocate that leadership who are willing to, you know, see this person as a leader. I mean, that's invariably true. And we invariably lose that when we look at the leader as being the sole agent of historical change. Now, Obama is the most extreme contemporary example of somebody who kind of puts the kind of almost challenges that theory because he's so charismatic, and it's hard to imagine, you know, another person, you know, mobilizing that energy the way he did. But still, without that, I mean, without the times, imagine Obama running for office in as president in 2000, the year 2000, pre 9/11, pre Bush era, pre reaction to Bush era. He would have gotten nowhere. There wasn't the support for that. Imagine in 2004, even. He would have been totally seen as an outsider, way too risky, blah, 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 blah. There has to be the mood and the climate that permits, you know, that allows any person with and any person's program to emerge. Ultimately, it's all rooted in the people, and our historical narrative has to be told in such a way that it acknowledges both the leadership and the people who acknowledge that leadership, who enable it to happen.
All right. We do need to take a break. Again, our guest on the line from Northern California is author Ray Raphael. He has just released a fascinating new book, one in a series of books about the American Revolution. This is one is called Founders, The People Who Brought You a Nation. Be back in just a moment.
Living now, here but for fortune, placed by fate's mysterious schemes, who'd believe that we're the ones asked to try to rekindle the pain.
Hey, and John Quinlan here on Forward Forum. Once again, special Independence Day edition of a show, one of the favorite shows of the year for me. We have on the line a wonderful guest, Ray Raphael, who is the author of Founders, The People Who Brought You a Nation. Little Arlo Guthrie coming in, Patriot's Dream. Little irony there in some of the dreams that he's depicting and some of the ways that perhaps Patriot's dreams haven't been realized over the years. We're going to be speaking with Ray Raphael about some of the folks that you may not have heard of over time, other than those six or seven kind of founding fathers who get all of the credit. And so some very powerful contributions by individuals, but also a notion of this collective nature of what happened with the American Revolution. What do you think? Does this make sense? Is it possible that we've really gotten the story that wrong over the years? And why is it important for us to revisit this history and really understand what's at the foundation of what this country stands for? 321-1670 is the number. We invite your participation. Well, Ray, hey, we've got a little less than a half an hour to cover a lot of territory. I did want to at least touch on a number of the different seven individuals that you talk about, and we started with Tim Bigelow, this blacksmith, again, facilitative leader out in the outlying township. If you want to expand on him a little bit, that's fine. But two that I wanted to make sure we covered were Mercy Otis Warren, a woman who just made some remarkable contributions we've never really heard about before. And then a young man of 14 at the time of the Revolutionary War was starting, Joseph Plum Martin. So I'll let you take it from there. All right, just one second.
My idea in the Founders book was to, in order to broaden and deepen the story, I wanted to get a diverse set of characters. I wanted to get some from high, some from low. You know, so I do have George Washington and some other powerful people that we'll talk about later. And then I also have these people from what I call history from below. The village blacksmith, Timothy Bigelow, is one, and Joseph Plum Martin is one. Because if I have George Washington as one of my characters, which I think I have to do, if I'm actually telling an honest narrative of the Revolution, it's going to make a lot more sense to put in this national iconic figure who actually led the Continental Army and served as a pivotal force in the entire evolution of the national identity, George Washington. But if I have him, then he's nothing without his army. So how do I represent his army in the sense of only one person? How do I choose a person? So I choose a private, and his name is Joseph Plum Martin, and he's easy to follow because after the war he wrote this amazing narrative of his adventures in the war, and he was involved in the war from 76 clear to the end in 83. But the thing is about Martin is he's such an everyday soldier, an everyman soldier. I mean, he kind of represents almost the soldiers of the ages you mentioned as a kid. Even before he's a soldier, he represents it. Because at Lexington and Concord, when they sound out the alarm and say we have to mobilize and run up to fight the British in Boston, the alarm reaches his hometown, Milford, Connecticut, another rural community, and all his older buddies march off to war, and he can't because he's only 14. And just seeing his description of being left behind while this older buddies, you know, run off and they're going to come back with, this is a quote, tales of their hairbreadth escapes. And while I'm stuck here on the farm, you know, so Anyway, that's his mentality. He doesn't know nothing about the politics of things, but that's just the way kids are. And it's kids with these kind of orientations that do a lot of the fighting in this war and all wars. So the next year, when they come recruiting again, he's only 15. But he convinces his grandparents, who he's living with, to allow him to go. Because if he doesn't, he promises, he threatens to run away and join a privateer, which is even worse. Go out to sea, and they'll probably never see him again. So anyway, he joins the war, and he writes about his experiences with such vitality and honesty. For instance, his first look at battle in New York and how he's basically just shaking in his pants. I mean, the guy's so nervous. He's 15 and suddenly hears real warfare, and he sees people coming back from the lines all bloodied and suddenly realizes this is no child's play. And then he's placed on the front lines in Midtown Manhattan, right where the Midtown Tunnel is now, around 39th Street, to stave off, he and a bunch of other green farm boys, militiamen from Connecticut, are supposed to fight off 4,000 well-armed, well-trained British redcoats who are about to land. After an hour of just nonstop bombardment, so much that he couldn't even—I mean, he hurt his ears, and he shook his body. I mean, amazing fireworks display last night was nothing compared to this. It's all aimed at you. What if all those fireworks are actually bombs coming your way? This is what he's experiencing. So he and the other militiamen flee. And he talks about this. What are we going to do? Poor Huff. He calls himself Poor Huff. What am I going to do? And so he runs away. And meanwhile, coming the other direction is George Washington, the general. And he sees his army flee. And he has a fit. One of the only time that I know of that he's really on record, you know, where a lot of people observe him just losing it, because Washington's a cool-headed guy, but seeing his army disappear just sends him off the edge, and he throws down his hat, and he rides around and, you know, kicks up his horse and starts yelling, why do I have to fight with men such as these? And the beauty you get out of seeing this multi-perspective approach is you can look at something like a war, you know, from both standpoints, you know, from the generals and the private standpoint. And Joseph Plum Martin just gives you a daily dose of this stuff, what it's like feeling, you know, when you're entering battle, what it's like just to survive when they're not feeding you. And he's going out on these kind of informal foraging expeditions, just trying to fill his belly. About half the book is these funny little things about filling your belly because you're not getting the rations. So anyway, that's a kind of personal view of the revolution, and it's told through the lives of through the eyes of this wide-eyed kid who then grows up and becomes a seasoned veteran. And boy, by the end of the book, by the end of his book, and therefore by the end of mine, because I use his narrative to tell his story, this guy is so old, so in a wise kind of way, mature, and he sees he's just way old beyond his years in terms of maturity, and he actually believes in by now he believes in those values he's fighting for, but simultaneously he's totally strained, because how can they keep doing this when they won't pay them, they won't feed them, they won't clothe them, and he's faced with this choice: should we desert the army? I mean, that's a huge issue.
I don't mean to keep on bringing everything back to the here and today, but it's so reminiscent of some of the testimonies I heard at this recent gathering of Iraq veterans called Winter Soldier, and again the idealism that they entered it with, and coming out the other end just feeling kind of abandoned.
Yeah, and boy, yeah, in Vietnam too. You see, the thing is, and the story, because what he really resents, and all the soldiers resented, the fact that the civilians for whom they were fighting did not give them adequate support, and so you get this big rift between kind of the military and the civilian life, and that's why, if you look politically now, that's the whole thing about like what Obama does is he's just trying to say, don't let this rift happen. You know, that's why he bends over backwards at every opportunity to praise the troops, blah, 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 because that's a very destructive rift, you know, when you get the soldiers and civilians feeling they're working at cross purposes.
Well, if we could, with limited time, I'll just also move on then to another one of the folks that you bring out. And, you know, the in general, I think our notion of the role of women at the time of revolution is a bit of a mystery. Gentleman's name is escaping me here, but he runs a constitutional law center here at the UW, and he wrote a book last year on Abigail Adams, for example. And we forget sometimes that we need to place this in the context of the times in terms of the roles of women at the time. But nonetheless, the role of a lot of women is very significant, including that of Mercy Otis Warren.
Yeah, well, I chose her to kind of highlight the female experience because she has a very dramatic turnaround. At the beginning, she's a Puritan. She's I think of her as the high priestess of Puritan virtue. She's true blue all the way. Her great-great-grandfather's on the Mayflower. Her husband's great-great-grandfather's on the Mayflower. She herself and raises her family with her husband and her five children literally 100 yards from Plymouth Rock. And at the outset, she embraces just a very traditional female role, which is supposed to have nothing to do with politics, not even no interest in it. Let alone activity. She's kind of anti-political. She writes these poems about come home, James. That's her husband, James Warren. Come home to the fireside bright, you know, and leave the contestuous, the ways of politics, where men start hating each other. Leave all that behind and leave the good pastoral life with me and my and your family, and submit to the will of men and submit to the will of God. You know, it's very religious, this notion of submission. I mean, women have to have this almost in those days because childbirth. There's so many die in childbirth. Their kids die. There's so much sickness around them. There's so little control that you see in all the women's letters. This notion of submission to providence and God's will be done. So mysterious and so on. But her brother is James Otis, the famous patriot. And he's the one who starts, the first one to argue in a court of law against the writs of assistance, the blanket search warrants in 1761, and becomes very famous and very influential patriot. And when he goes nuts in the late 1760s, Mercy Otis Warren just turns on a dime and basically takes his place. She's very well educated because she's been educated in their living room and across the street in their parlor and across the street at the parsonage with her two brothers who were being trained to go to Harvard.
She essentially eavesdropped in their tutoring, it sounds like, and became a part of it,
right? Well, more than eavesdrop. No, her father just, more than eavesdrop, her father just let her do the study.
Ah, okay.
She was there doing it. And so she's very well read in all the classics, history, and all that stuff, and European Enlightenment, and she carries, so she uses this knowledge, and kind of she's been paying attention, sneaking a peek at what's really going on, and she writes these outrageous, dramatic satires lampooning the British office holders in Boston, and she publishes them anonymously. She's very close with John Adams. She asked John Adams, "Have I gone too far for a person of my sex?" And he says, "No, because you're just telling people to behave themselves, and that's a good role for women after all." and then she writes other things through the years. She becomes a very prominent anti-federalist, prominent in the sense that her writing is prominent, not that she is, because again, she has to write anonymously.
And we need to break it just a second. I just want to jump to one point. And you mentioned a close relationship with Adams, but in later life, she actually kind of skewered him because she was disappointed that he didn't meet the bar in terms of her high expectations.
Yeah, exactly, because she writes a history finally in the early 1800s and finally in her own name. See, this is her development. She's gone all the way now to being active in another name, and now she's very active in her own name. She skewers Adams, who used to be literally her best friend. John and Abigail were best friends with the Warrens, and they loved each other. They trusted each other. But then John, in her mind, lost the faith. You know, he went off to Europe. He got seduced by power, and it culminated in this getting to be president and the Alien and Sedition Act. So she skewers him. And when he objects to that, they go back and forth for letter after letter, and this woman, who wasn't even supposed to participate, won't back down an inch, and she's upholding the high virtues of the revolution. She was an anti-federalist thing. That's what she thought she was doing, because she didn't think the revolution should be that concentrated on power. So what a character.
Oh, that's wonderful. Again, we're speaking with Ray Raphael. He is the author of Founders, The People Who Brought You a Nation. Some fascinating untold stories here, in this case of seven different patriots that you don't hear much about. Again, against a backdrop of the collective story of the American Revolution, not just a few founding fathers, but the grassroots movement that made all of this possible. 321-1670 is our number. We'll be back with Ford Forum in just a moment.
Hot summer weather creates...
Yankee Doodle do or die. A real live nephew of my Uncle Sam, born on the 4th of July. I've got a Yankee Doodle sweetheart. She's my Yankee Doodle joy. Yankee Doodle came to London just to ride the ponies. I am that Yankee Doodle boy.
And welcome back to Forward Forum. John Quinlan here, a little bit of James Cagney and Yankee Doodle Dandy. You know, again, resonant with what we're talking about here, those Yankee Doodle Dandies, those founding fathers we often hear of, that's only a part of the story and often a very distorted part of the story. Ray Raphael is the author of a book called Founders, The People Who Brought You a Nation. He also is the author, with editor Howard Zinn, of A People's History of the American Revolution, getting at some of the reality behind some of those stories. It's very important for us to learn more about all of this. If you have questions or comments about all this, give us a call, 321-1670. And Ray, one of the folks that we want to make sure we also talk about actually is a father and son team. And just their relationship is interesting in a number of different ways. And that would be Henry and John Lawrence. And they also epitomize, due to the different stands they take on this issue, the dissonance that was there over the issue of slavery.
Yeah, I wanted to include some regional differentiation, and I would also have liked to include an African-American, because they accounted for a 1 in 6 of the population, mostly enslaved Africans. The term African-American isn't quite correct, because African-American sort of implies these people think of themselves as American. They thought of themselves as basically as Africans enslaved in America at that point. And so their story is critical, and they actually held, in a sense, the military balance of power, or people thought and feared they did. So they figure a lot in the narrative, but I could not find the example of I could not find a single individual who wound up fighting with the Patriots, because I wanted to call my story Founders, because that's I wanted to say, well, who are our founders? And those African Americans, most of them who fought actually fought with the British. Some fought with the Americans. But again, these stories, we just don't have the documentation on any individual. So what I did is I took a really large slave owner from South Carolina, and that's we never hear about South Carolina in the Revolution, and it was huge. And show his participation. He's a very conservative person. He has a bunch of slaves. He's a slave dealer at the beginning of the war. He lays off that, but he has several plantations, hundreds of slaves, and he's very conservative. He's what he's called a government man. But when he winds up tweaking the nose of a customs inspector who has confiscated two of his ships, that was a custom at the time. It was kind of a preliminary challenge to a duel, tweaking the nose. He becomes a patriot, because what else can you do if you've offered that kind of insult to an official? And so even though he's very conservative, he rises in the patriot ranks. He actually becomes a president of Congress. He is on a diplomatic mission to borrow money from Holland, gets captured and thrown into the Tower of London. So he's the highest ranking political prisoner in our nation's history. We don't know anything about him. Again, one of these stories, it's not only small people who are left out of the story, it's important people, too. And there's another I want to talk about, the most powerful individual, Robert Morris, talk about in a minute, how he's left out. But anyway, so this large slave owner, who's now in the Tower of London, he has a son, and a John, who winds up very eager to fight, and he offers his services to Washington. He's one of Washington's aides. He's Alexander Hamilton's best friend. And And he has a curious relationship with his father because they're both patriots, but he's very daring and dangerous, and he's always putting himself in harm's way, and his dad is trying to calm him down. You're not going to help the cause by getting killed, and plus, think of your poor daddy.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing they have a difference is the relationship to slaves, because John Lawrence says, you know what we should do? We should arm the slaves. Arm the slaves. And have them fight with the patriots, and then after they help us win, we will free everybody who helped us.
Mm.
Now imagine that notion in South Carolina, how that played in South Carolina. Not very well. But it's through these kind of discourses that we can actually look at issues of slavery and also individual slaves. So I deal with several individual stories within of people who are enslaved by Henry Lawrence. He says, oh, I'm such a good master, all my slaves are happy. And the same day he's writing this, we have a letter from somewhere else about five of his slaves are running away to the British.
Well, he offers a critique of the behavior of one of his slaves. And, of course, it's all grounded in the notion that the guy is great when he behaves, but when he starts to speak up for himself or something, that's where he's trouble.
Yeah, a lot of these – what we know about slaves, a lot of it is the runaway the runaway notices, they put the notices for the runaway slaves in the paper. They sometimes talk about their saucy tongues.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, you got it. But then sometimes they talk about these people who are very slow and won't work. And Henry does that. And what's happening? A lot of these slaves, when there's no more resistance, it's kind of a work slowdown. I mean, that's what it was all about. But listen, I want to talk about one more fella.
Sure.
Because when you think of the story. Being this voice being eliminated from the national narrative. And, of course, you say, well, it's all the common people that are eliminated, and maybe it's all for political point there. But it's more than that. It's we want the stories we want, and by God, if a story is a little too ugly, we just don't want to tell it, even if it's true and even if it's about powerful people. So the most powerful civilian in revolutionary America was a fellow named Robert Morris. Now, listeners out there, just think of all you know about Robert Morris, and now think about why you don't know anything about him. He runs the government twice, all by himself, once for only a few weeks in the winter of 76-77, when he's issuing all the contracts, many of them to himself, by the way. He's the wealthiest man in America. So he's on every committee of Congress, and he issues the contracts, and then quarter of them go to his own firm, kind of a Cheney-Halliburton connection.
I was just thinking, yeah.
And then he's also a privateer, legalized piracy, and he's also hoards scarce wartime goods, war profiteer, and to jack up the prices so he'll make more. So he's not very popular. At one point, a mob actually goes after him in the middle of the war. But when the nation becomes bankrupt at the end of the war in 1781, and a dollar, continental dollar, literally won't buy pennies worth of goods, they turn to the richest, most powerful, most well-connected, the only man who can help them, Robert Morris. He says, why should I work? I already gave my time for Congress. I'm in private business now. And they say, well, okay, well, you can continue in private business. You can make as much money as you want as long as you also do this. And then he says, well, how about I get all the powers? I want to know everybody in the government has to come through me. I can hire and fire anybody I want. They say, sure, no problem, anything you want, boss. And so they give him unprecedented powers, and he comes through with the goods. He offers his credit, which is good, to back up the governmental credit, which is bad. They're called Morris notes, notes on the U.S. Treasury. And if the Treasury can't pay, they're countersigned by Robert Morris. People accept them, and the nation goes on its way. This guy, and he ran the government for 3 years in this way. He set up the First National Bank. Bank of North America. And he's kind of what we think of Hamilton in the 1790s. This guy's doing it in 1781 and 84, same program. Hamilton just adopts his program 10 years later. But we don't know a thing about him because we don't want to listen, my children, and you shall hear of the dubious exploits of the financier. This kind of,
yeah. Exactly. Well, self-interest doesn't really fit into the narrative very well.
No, self-interest doesn't, and this guy is all about self-interest. He's into the revolution because he's into free trade.
Yeah,
and that's what puts him there, but that's his self-interest. In the new nation, after he turns down the offer for Secretary of Treasury, which, of course, then goes to the second choice, Hamilton, he goes into private business. He invests in 6 million acres. 6 million acres. Can anybody conceive of that? This is across seven states. Even that is too much for the richest man in America during a credit crunch. The notes that he's written, you know, borrowed or called in, and he spends 3 years in debtor's prison the last 3 years. So imagine that narrative. But if you're actually at the time and you want to talk about an honest narrative and talk about the financial difficulties of the nation, which were huge, and which underpinned everything, and the nation without him would have literally imploded. He is the one individual in a civilian mode, who is absolutely responsible for the nation's survival. Without him, there would have been Washington literally wouldn't have had an army, let alone any supplies. And we don't recognize this guy because we don't like his story. And it's the same thing as this. We don't like the story of the bottom-up revolutionaries who really can overthrow a government, you know.
Again, the power of the story. Yeah, absolutely. Ray, I have to interrupt because we're coming to the end of the hour here. Again, we're speaking with Ray Raphael. We really encourage you to check out this fine book, Founders, The People Who Brought You a Nation. RayRaphael.com is one place that you can find out a great deal more. And something I'd love to bring you back, because I know that you also have a history in working with the civil rights movement. I imagine there's some resonances there in terms of these untold stories and the fact that it wasn't just a few folks. But
they relate to each other, and that's the thing. And maybe if we do another discussion, we could talk about the relationship of these social movements and the dynamics, what similar dynamics they have.
That would be terrific. Again, RayRaphael.com. This is Forward Forum. See you next week.